Gosh, John, I forget how good you are at karate. That's incredible.
I know, man. I mean, it's all about the right belt.
It is. Timing, you know? Or your leather belt.
Exactly.
I feel like maybe, is that not, that's what you meant?
Not really, okay. But speaking of, Dave, wow, I'm just going to try to transition to save you. Finally, Dave.
Yeah.
Warm spring days are arriving.
Oh,
am I right?
Isn't it great? You know what? I need a new pair of shades that I don't have to baby. Do you know what I'm saying, John? I don't want to take care of them. Let me put them on, take them off, and not have to worry about
them. Hey, Dave, I know exactly
what you mean. Sorry, I didn't mean to rant.
Knock around is the solution. They've been making high-quality shades that don't break the bank since 2005.
Oh, wow.
And they've actually been my personal go-tos for years.
Oh, yeah. I love Knock Around, John. They have over 20 different frame styles, so there's something for everyone, including tons of kids' pairs.
That's right. So whether you're looking to rep your favorite sports teams, you know, like you're a sports guy, spend some relaxation time in the yard, or cruise down Broadway with the windows down like Dave does all the time.
All the time.
Every Tuesday and Thursday and Saturday. Knock Around, that's what you need.
Yeah. All of their lenses have UV 400 protection, which is basically like sunscreen for your eyes, which, by the way, I've tried that and it hurts. Use the sunglasses, everybody. With polarized adult pairs starting at $28, you can get a few pairs to leave in your car, toss in your beach bag, or lend to a friend in need.
Dave, that is such a good price that I might buy a pair just to intentionally lose them.
I don't love that logic, John, but
I know,
you do have a history of misplacement. It's Knock Around.
Don't fight me because of the karate stuff.
But it could be perfect for you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So, Dadville fans, don't squint through family beach days or trips to the park. Check out knockaround.com and use the promo code DADVILLE15 for 15% off your order.
That's DADVILLE15 for 15% off your order at knockaround.com.
Well, good day to you. It's Joel with The King Country dropping in to let you know that our brand new film, Unsung Hero, is in theaters now.
It's Luke here. We've teamed up with the creators of Jesus Revolution to bring you this adventure of a lifetime. It's a powerful, true story about a family uniting, growing in their faith, and facing the impossible together.
In theaters now, unsunghero.movie for more information.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
Hi, I'm Dave Barnes.
And I'm John McLaughlin.
And welcome to Dadville.
Dadville is a podcast where we talk about life, love, and the pursuit of awesome dadding.
It's funny thoughts and deep talks.
So please, enjoy your time here in Dadville and enjoy this episode with...
John Mark Comer.
Dadville is sponsored by BetterHelp.
John.
Dave.
What would you do if you had an extra hour in your day?
Oh, man, that would be great. Yeah. I'd probably go for a longer run, you know, maybe play with the kids, write some music. How about you?
Yeah, I've done all of those at the same time, but I can only do it once. I think it would be similar, actually. I think a lot of us spend our lives wishing we had more time. I know I do.
Yep.
And we wonder how we would use it if we even could.
You know, I think the best way to make the most of the time that we have is to know what is really important and make it a priority.
You're right, John. And one of the most effective things we can do to help us find what matters most so that we can take the time to do more of it is therapy.
I agree, Dave. That was a really wordy sentence, but
thanks.
I agree.
Thanks.
I think therapy is a great way to focus on the positive and find our strengths. It's so helpful. It's been so helpful to me. It teaches coping skills, helps you set boundaries, empowers you to be the best version of yourself.
And, John, it isn't just for those who've experienced trauma. It can benefit anyone.
That's right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
So visit BetterHelp.com/Dadville today to get 10% off your first month.
That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Dadville.
I just want you to know, we're officially recording. Also, John Mark, I want to apologize because if you look in the video, you see that I have a mic right here that I'm not using, and yet I have on my headphone helicopter.
I'm just really excited that you are pursuing a new career in air traffic control. That's exciting.
Listen, and if I bop out for just a second, it's because we've got a couple we're having to land, and they're needing me to to be a part of.
I got a 777 on runner 297.
We got runner 29.
I see Bruce Willis out chasing a plane with
he's hanging off of it with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
A thing of gasoline.
Tom Cruise.
Yeah, Tom Cruise is hanging on the.
There's something else that is a shame that our listeners can't see. Not only that Dave is wearing air traffic control gear and no pants, but John Mark Comer, the lighting in your room is on point.
Just gorgeous.
Man.
Ooh, is it okay? I suck at all this
stuff. Is it called moonlight setting? Because it does seem like it's like a moonlight.
See, I was going sunrise. You know?
Oh, well, either one of them is celestial, yeah. So it makes sense.
It's just that California light, boys.
Sunshine. That's what we call you. That's what we call. That would be your wrestling name,
Golden
by the way.
State, California, I mean. Yeah.
Golden State Boy or California Light Boy would either be a great wrestling name for you. I also want to digress really quickly. We mentioned airplanes and people hanging off of them, and I'm halfway through the new Mission Impossible. And have y'all seen?
Apparently, he actually. That's real. That he's like in a harness, but apparently, they took off in an airplane with him hanging out.
That's what I heard.
Well, that's not even the one I'm talking about. The newest one has him on a motorcycle where he goes off the side of this basically mountain and parachutes. And they did it apparently numerous times, and it's him every time.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, at what point? Is that something where somebody sits down with him? Or
and you know, like,
I've heard an interview.
You're 67 years old, you know. Maybe we should, like,
I don't know.
You know,
is this something
we have computers
about?
For this now, and stuntmen are 21 and think this is a good idea. You don't need to do this.
He's like, I eat computers. Like
apparently,
that for
he did. Like, he had a safety team that told him, like, you can't do this. I don't know which one it was.
Oh, yes.
And then he, like, fired the safety team.
That happens to me a lot. I'm just like so committed to my craft that my safety team is like, John Mark, you can't do this.
JMC,
and I'm like,
this
forget
is
you.
Far.
I will sacrifice my life.
That's
for the-
too much Sabbath.
Happens to me a lot. It's like a team of therapists, actually. They're like,
yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. So it's, well, I mean, everybody can hear the dulcet tone. You're just beautiful voice, John Mark. So they know it's you. But I'm going to read just the quick bio because that's what we do here. And yours has been curated so well. I want to go ahead and congratulate you on that one. It's you got it dialed in. The humility is on point. It's right up front. But just so everybody knows, here we go. Let's do it for a third time, everybody. John Mark Comer, we call him JMC, is a teacher, writer, and the founder of Practicing the Way. After serving as the pastor for teaching and vision at Bridgetown Church in Portland, Oregon, nearly two decades, John Mark and his family now reside in L.A., Los Angeles. City of Angels, which is sort of a spiritual move, where he serves as a teacher in residence at Vintage Church LA. He is the New York Times bestseller, author of 7 books, including how many books is that for all of us, John? We always do this count. If it's all three of us are counting,
oh my
books
gosh, read, I'm terrible at math, written. But that, it would be seven.
Seven, that's right. We've all, between us, the three of us, yeah. The International Bestseller, that's my favorite. This is my favorite new gig. That's my favorite little bit we do,
John.
You're
reading off a website somewhere. I don't even know.
No, I'm not. This
is
my note. It's a note.
It's an email from my assistant or something.
Listen.
That thing's not going to copy and paste itself. We had to do that with our own hands.
That's true.
Thank you. She's a gem.
Okay, so you got to let me get through this because people are dying to hear the last part. Ruthless Elimination.
Nobody is dying to hear the last part.
No, yes, they are. Yes, they are. His podcast, John Mark Comer Teachings and Rule of Life, which I'm saying this outside. I love those podcasts, by the way, have been ranked on top religion.
Was that in parentheses from Deanna?
Yes, no.
I love those podcasts, by the way.
Please
but say this.
This
with feeling.
Anyway, everybody loves them. Everybody loves you. So we're thrilled to have you back.
Yeah,
so,
your third time, man.
This is, you're getting into some rare.
You got
air here.
A Starbucks gift card in the mail. It's on its way.
You are going to give that to the first homeless guy you see, and that's a ministry. One of the things,
getting a breakfast
that is a big,
bagel on YouTube.
Yeah, you are. Cake pop.
Seven
bucks
and
cover
one
the whole
breakfast
thing.
Bagel.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. That's exactly right. So something you've had big life change since we have seen you.
Yeah,
and. I mean, big life change. You moved to California.
Yes.
And, I mean, I wouldn't say you started a new job. You've sort of
kind of
changed a job.
Does
right?
it feel like
right.
you've started a totally new career?
I think both are true. I think I'm still sorting that out. Yeah, there are days where I feel like I'm doing what I've been doing since my early 20s, and other days where I'm like, holy cow, who am I? What am I doing? Deep into midlife existential crisis.
Right.
And learning a new skill, you know, so much new in my life. And I'm learning a lot, which is great. I mean, I love learning, but there is a stress component to it too, you know? So yeah, I think it depends on what day you catch me on.
Do you file this under sort of the second mountain stuff, or do you feel like this was like kind of always coming in some ways? You know what I mean? Like when you, because I mean, changing a job, how old are you?
25. I'm 43.
43. You know, 43 almost is 29. No small. If you listen to Jesus, who knows how old you are. But you know, that it's no small thing. I mean, and moving, those are two seismic activities in your life. Did you feel like you saw that coming for a while, or was that something you're kind of like, man, I just sort of woke up and this became a thing I kept thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, for a while, not long term. I think, you know, when you're young, you're just trying to make your way in life and go out into the world and discover what you were meant to do. But I think it hit me maybe about 10 years. So we planted a church very young, like way too young. In hindsight, would never do it again. But at 23 years old, and we were with a community of people. It wasn't just us at the beginning. But we were in the kind of lead role a couple of years into that. And so, you know, I would say about 10-ish, I don't know if that's the right timeline in, but a number of years into that, I began, it's a really hard job to lead a church. You know, I have so much respect for pastors in general and they get so much hate mail right now and so much flack, and a lot of it is well-deserved, but what it doesn't name is just how difficult that job is. And that's not a sob story. I can say that now that I'm no longer a lead pastor.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's so funny. We're starting an organization from scratch. It has grown crazy fast. We're having to raise millions of dollars. We just went from like me and Deanna to 20 employees in a year. It's very, and it is so much easier than leading a local church.
Really?
I mean, it's like so much easier. Oh my gosh, it is so much easier. And it's hard work. We're working our tail off, but right, it's so right. much easier. There's an emotional and spiritual component to the lead pastor role that is hard to name. Anyway, point of that is not sob story. Lead pastor, I hope you have a good therapist. The point is, I think I figured out maybe 5 or 10 years into that oh, this is too difficult of a job to do well long-term in the sense of like for my whole life. So I hesitate to say this because there are beautiful exceptions to this rule, but they are very rare. I rarely see somebody in the lead pastor role do well past 20 or 25 years or so. They might do well, like morally, like I think of a couple pastors I know that have been at their church 40 years or one's 52 years or something, and no breach of integrity, moral, upright, loved and respected, but they haven't been giving catalytic, you know, leadership to that community. Because a lot of it feels kind of like you're pushing against powerful forces, both in culture and in group dynamics and in people. And it, you know, it's like parenting. It's like, can you imagine, even think about parenting. You guys have little kids. Can you imagine parenting the way you're parenting now for 60 years? You would probably it takes an energy spend that is, there's even a season of life for it. And then there's a season where you're like, man, I would not have the energy. It's like when you talk to grandparents that, you know, like I think of my parents that raised 4 kids. And now when they watch their grandkids for like 3 days, they're just like, they need a week's vacation afterward. They're like, oh, this is so hard. Like, you did this for 25 years, you know?
That's parallel, actually.
You can only do it for so long. So I think I figured out, hey, 20 years in, I will be, you know, in my early 40s. If I did 25 years, a quarter century, I'd be in 48 or something like that. And so I began to then realize, okay, I probably have a whole second half of life ahead of me. And, you know, begin to then ask, what do I give my life to in a meaningful way? So I'd like to think that the move, and I'm from California originally, we were in, you know, the Pacific Northwest for so many years, but I'm from California originally. So I'd like to think that coming back to California, starting a new organization, moving into a kind of role of more writer, spiritual director is kind of, that's my second mountain, second half of life journey. Mm-hmm. But I'm also 43. I'm sure there's still some ambition that is certainly motivating and animating some of my life, good and bad. And I think, you know, when 60-somethings hear me talk about the second half of life, they all chuckle at me.
Right.
So maybe I'm just in delusion and been reading too many books by wise people and want to map myself farther than I actually am. I don't know.
Did this move at all feel like, and I don't want to jump ahead too much, but there was a spot in your new book that I love, by the way, where you talked about practicing the way of Jesus. Lean into your personality. We all often feel like we just have to go against it. Like it has to feel hard. It has to feel unnatural. Does this move that you guys just did, does it feel like a giant leaning into what feels natural to you? Like that's what I want it to be for you. You know what I mean? I just had a friend of mine who moved actually out to California in San Diego. And he's like, we want to live by the water. And there's a part of me that's like, well, you can't just do that. You can't just do what you want to do. Wait a minute. You know, does it feel that way to you? Like I'm just leaning into what I'm good at and what I want to do and what comes naturally to me.
Yeah. You know, Cal Newport has that idea of vocational equity. That in the same way, you know, this is a middle-class analogy, so I'm sure people could take issue with it, but that, you know, you save up your money or you find a way to get a down payment, and your first house is rarely the house that, like, you want to be in long-term. It's the house you can afford. So my wife and I have remodeled. We're actually in the middle of remodeling a house because LA prices are crazy, so we bought an old fixer-upper. Mm-hmm. But this was our fifth remodel, and it was because we're trying to build equity so that we could kind of get to a house that is the kind of place that we would love to be, you know? And I'm sure there's some discontentment stuff in there, but some of it was just working hard and trying to build a life for our family, you know? And so we have this great old house. We love where we live. So it's considered LA, but if you came to my house, my neighbors are very LA people, but I live up in the mountains, in the Santa Monica Mountains at 1500 feet on a quarter acre. I have a 150-year-old barn in the back of my property.
Jeez.
No cell phone reception. We're on like propane and septic. I was walking my dog this morning and a coyote ran right in front of us. It's awesome.
Yeah.
I live like up in the oak trees in the mountains, and I'm, you know, and then we drive into the city. My kids go to school in the city. And so it is LA, like the culture is LA, but my actual house is up in a mountain, up in the mountains, up in a canyon. So it's a really special place. But I had to build up a lot of equity over, you know, 20 something years of remodeling houses and backbreaking effort to get to the spot where we were able to, it was still a stretch, but buy this old home, but beautiful home up in the mountains where I could see myself dying here. I could see myself dying in this home.
Yeah.
And I think there's a vocation. So Newport's idea is that vocation works that way. So again, I'm not saying this was my story, but you know, he talks about how you all have to start. Not all of us can start being amazing rock stars. Some of us have to start like working lame jobs, you know? So you have to have the job you don't want in order to get the job that you want long term. Mm-hmm. And some of that's actually deeply good for the human soul. Some people that achieve success really early on, I think it's actually terrible for them.
Right.
It does. They can't even enjoy it. They don't realize what they have. They don't
learn
to work. They don't learn. Look at Dave. They end up like Dave, just this miserable curmudgeon comes to mind.
Non-pantsed helicopter.
And then trying to get a job as an air traffic controller in the middle of their life.
I mean, it's sad.
So sad.
It's sad. No.
Listen, if you build it, they will come. That's what I've been told.
That was a very long way, John, of saying, yes, some things I love. I love coming back to California where I'm from. I love being in the sunshine. Not a day goes by where I do not have a wave of genuine gratitude flow through my body. Had one this morning walking my dog in a t-shirt at the end of February underneath an oak tree, just screaming authentic love and praise to Jesus.
That's so great.
And I love, this is the first time I've always been an introvert in an extrovert's job for my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And,
well said. That's really well said.
And pastoring was such an honor. I'm pretty relational. But I kind of love, there's a lot about pastoring that was really hard for me. I love kind of preaching and writing and teaching and distilling, you know, and synthesizing and simplifying and distilling Christian spirituality into a way that is hopeful, hopefully helpful for people. And I love one-on-one and kind of, I love, you know, spiritual direction, mentorship. I love doing life around a table with a very small group of people. Everything in between is pretty stressful for me. And most of my job was the in between.
Yeah.
And, or a lot of my job was that in between. And I don't say that in a cynical way. It was an honor to serve. But this is the first time where I've ever had a job where I am required to be an introvert in order to succeed at my job. And it requires long hours of creativity and writing and hard work. And I love that. So yes, I mean, there, it probably makes my life sound better than it really is. It's actually, the transition has been brutal on me and on my family, you know, in particular moving. So it is not all rosy. There's some aspects of it that have been really difficult. But yes, it feels like finally I'm in a job that I could do for decades joyfully. I'm back in California. It's pretty, I live up in the mountains, pretty special.
Hey everybody, it's John here. No Dave, just pure John. And I know what you're thinking right now. You can hear it in my voice. You can hear how low on electrolytes I am. I'm craving some electrolytes, and I'm going to tell you exactly what I'm going to take to remedy that. I'm going to take Element. But Element is spelled in one of those cool ways that makes us 40-somethings feel young and hip when we figure out how to say it correctly, finally. It's the letters L-M-N-T. Element. Don't you feel cooler already? I do. I'm 41. Anyway, Element replenishes my electrolytes with a tasty drink mix with everything you need and nothing you don't need. That means a lot of salt with no sugar. It contains a science-backed electrolyte ratio of sodium, potassium, and magnesium with none of the junky junk. No sugar, no coloring, no artificial ingredients, no gluten, no fillers, none of that stuff. Electrolytes are what I crave. And again, you can hear it in my voice. I'm going to take it as soon as I'm done with this ad. But you don't have to be a professional brawny athlete to benefit from Element. Electrolytes facilitate hundreds of functions in our bodies, including the conduction of nerve impulses, hormonal regulation, nutrient absorption, and fluid balance. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're like, John, you've sold us, but what is your favorite flavor of Element? I'm so glad you asked. It's watermelon salt. That's it. You? I don't know. Yours might be mango chili. I'm not sure. Just get out there and try it. Because right now, Element is offering a free sample pack with any purchase. The Element sample pack includes one packet of every single flavor, so you can try all of them and figure out what your favorite one is. This is the perfect offer for anyone interested in trying all the flavors or who wants to introduce a friend to Element, maybe. Get yours at drinklmnt.com/dadville. This deal is only available through the Dadville link. And Element offers no questions asked refunds. So that's drinklmnt.com/dadville. Try it totally risk-free. If you don't like it, share it with a salty friend and they'll give you your money back. No questions asked. You got nothing to lose.
So then, no joke, it's like it just came out of nowhere, landed in our front yard, and I just, and at that point, I'm thinking, well, I have to deal with this now.
Right. And it was the Wall Street Journal? Or?
Yes! I'm not subscribed. I don't know where that comes from. I can barely read. Should have seen the guys he was driving off, and I was yelling at him, trying to throw it back in his window.
Yeah, yeah.
But it does lead me to this point.
Okay.
I'm craving Butcher Box right now. I know that feels out of nowhere, but that's the next logical.
Well, look, I'll tell you, for someone who can't read, you just read my mind.
Okay? Well done.
Like their beef and pork meatball skillet dinner. Hello.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I looked up the recipe on ButcherBox.com, and it was so easy to prepare, even for me.
Yeah.
The chipotle sauce, the crushed tomatoes, the onions, my mouth. was watering.
What about the 15-minute beef barbacoa tacos,
John? Oh, don't even get me
started. I used one package of BB, Butcher Box's, slow-cooked beef barbacoa. That is really fun to read and tastes even better. And pair that up with flour tortillas, crumbled cojita cheese, and sliced jalapenos.
Wow.
It is spicy, juicy, perfection.
Now, look, probably my favorite thing about Butcher Box is that it is the ultimate convenience.
Yes.
Right, just like the Wall Street Journal, they will throw it right on your front porch. It's delivered right to my doorstep, always with free shipping, always.
Yep.
And it's curated to my customized box plan. And you know what, Dave?
What?
It's just great to know that I'm always prepared with meat in my freezer.
That's right, and that's not a euphemism.
Nope.
I couldn't agree more, John. With ButcherBox, I take fewer trips to the grocery store, and I get curated tips. Could be beef tips, John.
Yeah, I don't know. Come on.
It's ButcherBox. It's Wild Wild West out there, and recipes based on my box. Plus, ButcherBox gives me peace of mind with high-quality meat and seafood you can trust.
You're right. Great recipes and a variety of high-quality cuts at an amazing value, plus exclusive member deals, recipe inspirations, guides, tips, and hacks. Now, Dave, it's time to tell them about our special deal.
Eat better this year with the best meat and seafood on the planet delivered to your door. ButcherBox is offering our listeners their choice of a weeknight meal essential. 3 pounds of chicken thighs, 2 pounds of ground beef, or 1 pound of premium steak tips. I mentioned them before, and I'm going to come back to them for free in every order. For a whole year, plus $20 off your first order.
Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dadville and use the code DADVILLE to choose your free offer and get $20 off.
Well, you know what? So, and it's what John is asking.
So if you write seven books, you can have a great life like me too.
Well, we've got, between the three of us, we actually do have seven books. So I'm now just, I want the effects of that.
Three podcasts. We've done three podcasts, guys.
Good gracious. But it is, you know, and speaking of the book, which by the way, I wouldn't even say the name of it, but it's called Practicing the Way, Be with Jesus, Become Like Him, Do As He Did. It's really great. But one of the things that I love about that idea, to your point, John Mark, is like, you know, as we sort of sacrifice ourselves, we sort of apprentice under Jesus. I think it's really easy to think like the way that goes, the sort of curve of life is then this like really hard, burdensome, which is funny because it's Jesus tells the opposite of that, but I tend to think like, well, here we go, like get ready for the hard stuff and what I think I love hearing you answer that question is saying like, you know, you're moving even more toward what you're better at and more excited in doing.
Yeah.
And it's now, you know, you daily have these moments of Thanksgiving, and not that Portland wasn't that, that's not all what you're saying, but I do think it's encouraging to hear from someone who's really practicing these things that the curve of your life is not just under Jesus and what he's trying to make you into, but what he's making you into is even more things that give you more joy. You know, is that it's not something where you're like, well, we moved to this place we don't want to be in and serving these people we don't really connect to, but hey, this is what, you know, it's good to hear that. I think it's good for me to hear. I think it's good for people to hear that this isn't something that, yes, it's going to be hard and life is life, but I think at the same time, you know, as you really a proponent for in this book, especially at the very end, like this is, it's beautiful. This is the way we were meant to be. And it's life-giving, it's freeing, it's affirming. It's these things, it's all the things we're, you know, wanting to be. And it's cool to see that your life is doing that.
It's interesting, like the central artifact of the Christian faith is the cross. And this, you know, picture, rhythm, dynamic reality at the center of what Howard Thurman called the religion of Jesus is death, burial, and resurrection, which is not just something that happened once to Jesus. It's something that happens all of the time to us. And we live this pattern of dying and renunciation and self-renunciation and death to self, followed by burial, periods of wilderness and waiting and silence and struggle, followed by resurrection and new life and Easter. And this is the rhythm. And one day we will literally live this rhythm with our bodies. We will die. We will go into the ground and we will wait for Jesus to resurrect our bodies to the age to come. In the meantime, we're practicing that rhythm through the seasons of our life. And so it's a both and. There is a whole aspect of discipleship to Jesus and of my life biography, some of which I'm not at liberty to talk about, that is just a painful death. Yeah. And everybody has their cross, and all of our crosses are a little bit different. And most of the most painful crosses, none of us would be at liberty to talk about on a podcast, especially if they were to involve other people. And, but on the other side of the death, that's the difference between Stoicism or whatever and the Christian faith, is resurrection, you know? So, there've been a lot of deaths over the last couple of years, and I'm just now beginning to wake up, I think, to some Easter morning in my life and some really special.
Oh, I love that. Gosh, that's encouraging to hear. I love that. Yeah, it's interesting. So a question for you, as you talk about that, for those who are listening, definitely not for me and John, because we, not that we're realized, but probably lowercase r realized. But like
enlightened is kind of the word, I think.
That's, I didn't want to say it, but yeah.
Yeah, but like how
you have ascended, you, that, you know,
I have into something and we don't know what yet. And that really is what makes it fun. But, you know, like how for those who are listening to this, that because I think it's easy for me, I'll admit, I was just sitting in our Sunday school and my dad was teaching, which is hysterical and fun, and all the things. But he was really doubling down on this idea of like, you know, like we're living sacrifices, like. We have to really give our, it's exactly what you're talking about in this book. Like, yes. We really have to give our lives to the Lord. Like it's, and you start the book so clearly talking about this, like everybody's following something, this idea that, you know, we're all disciples of something, but how, like when you think about what you said, and I love that you pull that rhythm in tighter, you know, that it's not our life is like this long death and then heaven is the resurrection, but this could be a daily, you know, weekly, monthly,
yeah,
whatever thing in our life, right? Like it's not, what are the ways that, and you sort of speak this in the book, but what are the ways if someone's listening going like, but how do I know that's happening in my life? Like what are the, and I know you say, I love this idea too, that like you're kind of, I'm summing this up so much, but you're sort of either getting meaner or more like the Lord.
Yes. You know, like this idea
with, you either meet,
you're
like,
getting
really
worse
nice.
Or better. You're not just staying
worse
the same.
Better, yeah.
Yeah.
Like in the same that you pull that rhythm in tight, you know, like death, resurrection, what are the rhythms that those of us who are really going like, man, I just don't know if I'm doing this right. What are those little tighter rhythms in our lives where you go, oh no, it is happening because I see this or I see this. You know what I mean? Like how do you think in that way about these things?
Wow. Well, I think some people never experience resurrection because they're not willing to die. And, you know, death to self, take up your cross is like a voluntary. So cross is not a metaphor for just the pain and suffering that all people face in life, follower of Jesus or not. It's for the death and the denial that we voluntarily accept and take on our shoulders as an act of apprenticeship to Jesus. But, you know, to use a really pragmatic analogy, this is a one, just the one that comes to mind because this is a dad podcast, right? Is this still a dad podcast? Kind of, sort of?
It sure is. Yes.
You know, I was thinking about, this came up just in a recent conversation this morning. This is why it's in my brain. You know when like you have little kids and they talk at you, not with you?
I'm very familiar with that.
And yeah. I don't know if any of your kids are talkative, but two of mine are very talkative and they will just talk at you for so long. And when they were little, it was like, you know, about Disney movies and cars and, you know, becoming a ninja. And it was just exhausting. I mean, it was just so, yeah. To try to pay attention and listen was so hard. And I remember a parent saying to me, an older, wiser parent saying, you know, it's really important in those years that you listen to your kids when they talk at you about Lightning McQueen or whatever nonsense, because you want them when they're 16 to talk to you about girls and talk to you about somebody that offered them marijuana and talk to them about faith, you know? And if you're not willing to listen now, then they won't want to speak to you later.
And that's a good point.
It was such good advice to me at a young, you know, so I've done that very imperfectly, But, you know, so it's, if nothing else, that was aspiration. Like, I want to listen to my kids. What she did not tell me is that they still talk at you all through their teenage years. It's just about other things that you don't care about. It's like, you know, my oldest
You're
son
like, guys,
was like,
I'm a writer. You need to compose this better. You're losing me.
And I have wisdom to offer you that you don't want to listen to. You just want to talk to me about all these things I do not care about, you know?
Yes.
And my kids are wonderful. One kid's like a diehard cinephile, and like he will just nerd out about all this film trivia about who did the cinematography on this, what kind of camera they used, and how they got this shot. And I'm just thinking, I do not care. Let's go see the movie and talk a little bit about the philosophy and then move on with our life. And then it's just like, I know the camera lens and the angle and who mentored him. I'm just like trying to listen. My other kid is even more difficult. This is the kid that would talk to me about Lightning McQueen for hours on end when he was like, that movie Cars came out when he was little.
Oh yeah.
And now he's just obsessed with like, what's the word for like the Japanese version of Fast and Furious? It's like JDM
Something
like that. He's obsessed with cars. He's 18. He's like all this and this underline, this Japanese Nissan, whatever. And I'm like, where did you? I haven't bought a car in 18 years. Like I'm just like not even. So I'm trying to listen, trying to pay. He's like, this is how you. He's all he wants to get into drifting. I'm like, oh great, tell your mom that you're gonna get into drifting. That's great, you know. And so but it's the same. Like nobody told me that they keep. So all that to say, every time I'm in that conversation, there's a death to self involved. I'm like, I do not want to listen to you. I want to finish texting my work colleague back about whatever. There's a little death. It's a small death. It's a tiny death. Yeah. It's not a major death. It's not a, you know, nothing noble. No books will ever be written about parents that try to not pick up their phone and listen to their kids talk at them about random things. But the other day, my son sat down with me over dinner and he said, Dad, how's your work going? Tell me, how are you emotionally feeling about this season of your life? And my jaw just about fell through the Chipotle table. And I was just, you know, this is my cinephile son. He was 15. We were going to see the new Godzilla movie, which, by the way, was absolutely
phenomenal.
The Japanese
movie. Yeah,
it was absolutely phenomenal. And we got some Chipotle on the way to the movie theater. And my jaw just about fell through the floor. And both of my sons have been asking me questions lately. Dad, tell me, how are you? Da, da, da. And I realized, this is resurrection. This is, you know, that's that pattern. This is a lot of years of just death to self, micro death, paper cut death, but death to self. And then all of a sudden, now I have 15-year-old sons that want to sit and ask me about how my heart is and ask me about where, and like what, that's the dream. That's what we all, that's what every parent dreams of, you know? Every parent dreams of having that kind, every dad dreams of having that kind of relationship with their son and their daughter. But on the front side of that resurrection is a whole lot of death. And so that may be too pedestrian of an analogy and not
heroic
enough, but I just feel like parenting's full of death, burial, resurrection.
So I says to him, that's enough about me. Tell me more about your story. You know, you couldn't believe I asked.
Well, crazy. He's your therapist, so.
No, that's true. And he didn't answer, which was really frustrating.
Yeah, yeah.
John.
Yeah, what's up?
Now that I've told you that great story, why did you take us here into the belly of this giant fish?
I mean, lots of reasons, but atmosphere.
Okay.
You know, for one, I like to bring the stories from my teen study Bible to life.
Okay, that's cool.
You know that about me.
I just want to sort of circle back. Are we okay in here? Is this safe? It doesn't feel safe.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to run out of oxygen eventually, but I've done this like 100 times.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Just wait till we read about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Okay, John, I trust you. I trust you. And I trust the teen study Bible, too. Do you see what I did there?
Yeah, I did.
It's a classic. Mm-hmm. It comes in updated editions now available in the NIV, King James, and the new King James versions.
Ooh.
And it sold over 4 million copies.
That's almost 5 million copies, Dave. The Teen Study Bible is great because it helps teens discover how God's truths relate to their lives today, and it helps them apply God's word to issues that they face, like bullying, depression, peer pressure, and stress.
You'll also find notes, articles, book intros, character profiles, Q&As, and more, offering the knowledge, strength, and clarity to navigate life's challenges with Scripture. Scripture as your guide.
Find out more about the Teen Study Bible and order your copy today at amazon.com/teenstudybible.
Man,
Dave, Louise, yeah. I want to give a shout out. Yeah. And when I give a shout out, I always laugh because it just brings me so much joy to give a shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with free samples.
You know it, John. This time of year, my allergies are in fuego. They're always on the attack, but I use this and you should too.
Oh, I do, Dave. Every day in our house. Yeah. Luckily, for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D.
Designed for serious allergy sufferers, which is me raising my hand, Claritin D has two powerful ingredients in just one pill to relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose so you can breathe better.
This double-action combination of prescription-strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, and itchy nose and throat and sinus congestion and pressure with ease.
John, I've been taking Claritin D for my allergies for a long time, and it's been an absolute life changer. I can go for a run without my eyes watering. I may be crying, but it's not from allergies.
Totally different.
And I can sing without feeling like I have like a big old, let's not even call it a frog. It's like a toad.
It's like a family of toads.
It's a family. It's a turtle.
Yeah.
In my throat.
So, you ready to live life as if you don't have allergies?
Yeah, me.
It's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter.
Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed.
Do you feel like you have, I mean, you must know because of your book, The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry, which is one of my favorite books of all time.
Mm-hmm. Of all three that you've read, it was just really great.
Two and a half, but it still matters a lot.
Yeah. I mean, that's on the podium.
Kidding. That's very
kind. On the podium.
Thank you, John.
That's on the podium.
I mean,
that's
John. There are only two books that I'm like, these, you know, everyone should read this book every single year.
What's the other one?
It's a book I'm working on. No, I'm kidding. It's Mere Christianity. But you must be.
I like you guys so much.
It's a book I'm working on. I'm not even done with it, and I can tell you.
But
right
I
now,
do. I much. Still get it's mad painful. When people are unfamiliar with it, even though I haven't released it yet. I still get offended. But you must know that you are seen as like, well, you're the guy. You're the like. I shouldn't say this word, given what I read in your most recent book. But you're the willpower guy, right? Like you're the guy who's like, you know, the daily habit guy. You know, you're seen as someone who has got this down, you know. And I one of the things that I really love about
not by anybody who I actually do life with, by people's mental fantasies of me from a distance. But great.
Exactly.
Yes,
that's
going.
The way it goes.
Disclaimer. Done.
But one of the things that I love about your new book is I feel like you are very candid about, you know, how difficult some of these practices can be. And how, you know, incremental and, you know, easy on yourself, you should be, all that kind of stuff. But do you feel like, as you say, like, this is a death I have to die to right now. Like, I want to text my work friend back. I'm thinking about this, you know, work conversation that is on hold right now. Do you feel like you are better in those moments? Like, have you built up the sort of stamina in those moments? Or does it just never get harder?
Are you asking, like, through following some of the kind of practices and such that I advocate for in some of my work, do I feel like it's working? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Like, do I feel like I'm becoming more open to interruption? Is that the question? I'm trying to make sure I'm.
Or is it the type of thing where you're like, no, guys, this is just every day is a new day, and every day it's hard. Or is there like some kind of an inertia and momentum that happens after years and years of dying all these deaths that you're now feeling, I have a rhythm to my life now. That I'm actually, the momentum of my life is going in the direction. I'm not fighting against it all the time.
I think it's both in some ways. You know, James Houston, who was one of the first academics to write about spiritual formation up at Regent University. I believe he's still alive, but he would be very elderly now. He has this beautiful line I quote in the book, spiritual growth is the slowest of all human movements.
Mm-hmm.
It's the slowest type of growth there is, growth into people of love. And Eugene Peterson used to kind of land on the metaphor of a glacier. There's nothing slower than a glacier and few things that are more powerful and unstoppable than a glacier. And so I don't know, is flywheel the right analogy, where it's really hard at first and once you pick up momentum, then it kind of just has this like self-inertia? Maybe. I'm sure there's something to that. But I wonder if glacier is a different metaphor where it doesn't speed up, but man, mm-hmm. what it leaves behind in its wake as it slowly unfolds is the most beautiful, the Yosemites of the world, the most beautiful places you've ever been. I think the biblical metaphor would be a tree. And so I think, you know, I think I'm growing organically, which is to say there's real spiritual growth in my life. And about 100 years from now, I'm going to be freaking awesome.
I love that. I want to be amazing.
Well, didn't your wife said in the book, she's like, gosh, yeah, probably like slow. In your 60s.
Yes.
You'll probably.
What a great quote. Yeah,
that is a quote. That is not, I'm not, there's no hyperbole in there. She was dead. She wasn't trying to be funny or cute. She was like, yeah, I think you'll be in your 60s. You'll be happy.
It is the great, like, it is the craziest thing about life to me. And I've never felt that more acutely. I'm 45 than in the last 5 years of my life. I'm like, I've never been more well acquainted with my shortcomings. I mean, at 20, I thought I was like, this is it, man. I'm kind of killing the game.
And then you get married and you're like, I haven't even started yet.
Yeah. Oh, and it's like, it's getting worse every year. I mean, I'm praying to your point, like I'm getting more holy and becoming more like Jesus, but I'm also like, man, it's crazy how that direction is so, if nothing else, is just such a floodlight on my inadequacies and how things that I'm just so bad at. It's like such a weird.
But what you have to remember, Dave, is okay, so a couple things you have to remember. One is that our attention is always on the, rightly so, is always on the growth edge of our formation. So we're, and more than it is on the post side of our formation, meaning our brain is always going to key in more to, holy cow, I was just an idiot with my 5-year-old, or I just did the stupidest thing with my wife, or I just said the dumbest thing I should not have said, especially on whatever. It's not going to focus in the same way on how far we've come in certain aspects of our development. And that's part of the beauty of the don't let your right hand know what your left hand is doing. The beauty of the way formation works is it's you're being freed of your ego. You're being freed of yourself very glacially, slowly. And you know that you have actually achieved spiritual maturity in an area of your life when you do the right thing and you don't even think about it and you would never even stop to think about it. So you'll notice, like sometimes when you compliment older, wiser, super godly Christians and you say, you are so, you will notice if you're a perceptive person or intuitive person, they will look at you and what you see in their faces is confusion. Because they do not really even think about themselves that way. They don't perceive themselves that way. They are perceiving the growth edge of their formation. It's why I remember sometimes I would see elderly people in our church would come forward for the Lord's Supper and begin to weep. And I would think, listen, you're 83. You probably haven't sinned since 1991. Like what are you weeping over? You're like the kindest, sweetest old lady I know. But they're not thinking about how much better they are than the narcissistic 24-year-olds who think we're awesome or whatever. They're comparing themselves to Christ, and they're on their growth edge, and they've become so tender. And often the more serious – there's this beautiful conspiracy of grace where the more seriously you take your formation, the more aware of your brokenness – and spiritual poverty you become, and the more your prayer increasingly just becomes, Lord, have mercy. Yeah. And the more you realize our willpower is utterly in, it's just powerless against the things that matter most. So there's a dynamic there that, Dave, I think we'll probably feel more that way at 55 than 45 and more that way at 65 than 55 of, gosh, what, look at this brokenness, Lord have mercy. And you won't really even think about ways that you have been radically transformed by Jesus because they're just your new normal and you're not even thinking about yourself in that way. And that's actually a sign of maturity. It's like spiritual maturity is when you do the right thing without even thinking about it, and it doesn't feel like discipline or virtue or moral heroism. It just feels like breathing. That God, when you know word. That you've actually achieved maturity in one, and we mature unevenly, so in one area of your life.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I love, one of my favorite things that you wrote in this book, and I love it for two reasons. One, I love that it is somewhat tangible. And yeah. Two, I love that you said, like, the mark, the metric is, are you becoming more loving? Like, that is a one metric that you can, you know, as much as we can sort of self-analyze, but, you know, those close around you would probably be better judges of that as well. But if you're becoming more loving, then you know you are progressing. If you're not, then you're probably doing something a little
and
off.
The only disclaimer there is we have to define love as Jesus did, not love as, you know, our sweet friend Chris Martin would, or, you know, L.A. would, or...
our sweet friend.
He's actually not my friend. He's just a lovely soul, it seems like.
He's a huge listener on the pod. Just
shout out to Chris.
Everything. Shout out to our boy Chris. So, I mean, the word love is used a lot, and many people, what they mean by love is not what, you know, we mean by the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. Mm-hmm. But yes, that's it.
That I love this so much. One of my favorite parts of the book, where you quote Robert Mulholland about, it's sort of this idea that spiritual formation will be for the sake of others, and hearts being formed into the image of Christ for the sake of others. And I think that, to me, is just like, what a revolutionary thought. Like, just... I just so badly want to make this stuff about me all the time. Like, am I getting better? Am I doing, what are the things? And it's like the point of this whole thing. It's the service part that you talk about in the book too. Like, Jesus came as a servant, but just that idea that, like, you know, if this is going well, it's helping people around me a lot. It's not just, is my life getting better? Like, is the ground that I've been planted in, is it like, am I, you know, like, feeding into the things in my ecosystem? Do I see my family growing? Do I see my friendships growing? Do I see my work, you know, relationships growing? All these things. And that's really, really convicting to me, because I think I just can start drinking the Kool-Aid on, like, the self-reflection, self, you know. And it's like, to your point, there's something that's really, it's just really wonderfully frustrating, you know, just how counterintuitive and how that doesn't go that way. Okay, so one thing I want to make sure, I know we've got 3 hours with you, so I want to pace this well. No, one thing we have to talk about before you go, because I think it's just such a big part of this book, is the idea of the rule of life. And for anybody listening, this book is just unbelievably helpful with this, with how we think about rhythms and you know, apprenticeship versus discipleship versus, like, It's great. The I would say the apex of it really rests on this idea of the rule of life. Like, what are these things? How you kind of define them in the book? And I'll read this quickly, but the paragraph that I think helped me the most is, most people have a plan for their money, a plan for their time, and all sorts of plans for their education, retirement, career, family, kids, soccer team, which I love that, gym routine, and so on. But very few have a plan to be with Jesus and thoughtfully apprentice under him, which you talk about so much in the book, in such a way that over time they become the people who naturally do and say the things that Jesus said and did. And so these ideas of the rule of life are these ways that we do that. It's the ways, you say, we kind of do these things. We become more like Jesus. And so, you know, and if you can't, I've got these written down and I'm ready to rock. But could you sort of, and, you know, as John said, as we were getting ready, he's like, man, this could be a 3-hour conversation just talking about these. But for the sake of time, is there a way for you to kind of condense each of these, kind of walk the listeners through what those are, so they kind of have an idea? Like, people listening going, man, rule of life, I love this. I love this idea, like, the way of life. What are they and how do you define them?
Yeah. Like, what is a rule of life and how do I define that?
Or the nine.
The nine practices.
You know what I mean? Like just
kind of what the nine practices. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That would take a bit.
I know, and it's a tricky question because I know, but I didn't, you know, I was laughing with John. I was like, I've got him all ready. And I was like, I'd rather hear him talk about him, but without, you know, you being like, gosh, this is like, this would need to be like the Sermon on the Mount where I have like, you know,
yes. Well, I mean, practices are like the building blocks or the components that when you assemble them together, form a rule of life, form a life architecture of discipleship to Jesus. And it's not helpful to just start with a list of practices because most of us are exhausted and over busy and have too much in our life. And then we can just feel like, listen, I thought I was already supposed to go to church and pray and read my Bible every day. And I'm about 1 for 3 on both. And now you're telling me I have to like start fasting and practice Sabbath and do Lectio Divina and like all this stuff. And so you have to frame it the right way. You have to walk into it and you have to slowly but surely over a long period of time integrate. But, you know, those nine practices, which to name, you know, are just our attempt to group. There's no official list of the practices of Jesus or what some call the spiritual disciplines, because technically anything that you see Jesus do repeatedly in the four gospels, you could frame as a spiritual discipline. So for example, there's lots of stories about Jesus, you know, hiking, as we would say today, or going up onto mountains. And yet I've never seen a list of spiritual disciplines that had mountain climbing and hiking on it. But I actually think like hiking is a deeply spiritual experience for a lot of people. And I think it really should be like that would be a welcome addition to a classical spiritual discipline list. So what we did is we kind of took, you know, a lot of the kind of practices and disciplines that you see in the life of Jesus and down through the best of the Christian tradition and kind of did our best to group them into nine kind of categories or buckets. And the nine that we landed on for the work that we do with Practicing the Way is Sabbath, silence, prayer, fasting, scripture, community, service, witness, and generosity.
And I can't believe you nailed all those. Well done.
There it is. My order was a tad bit off. I'm a bit rusty today, boys. But And those are categories. So Sabbath for us, for example, would include Sunday worship and the practice of gratitude and celebration. Community would include, you know, the meal around the table, the Lord's Supper, the practice of confession, sharing our resources with one another, social justice in many ways. So they're categories, they're groupings. But I think what the best of the Christian way would offer to us after 2,000 years is that, you know, there's no one spiritual pathway for anybody to follow. There's no one-size-fits-all approach to a rule of life or spiritual formation. Your life, your personality matrix, your Enneagram number, your stage of life, your children, your children's personalities, it's all different. And we have follow one shepherd and we follow him together, but we all have our own journey to go on at the same time. But there are certain practices that should just find their way in some form into the life of every serious follower of Jesus, like scripture. There's no version of following Jesus where you don't regularly immerse your mind and imagination in the library of scripture. Now, you can do the old school evangelical, read through the Bible in a year. You can be a Benedictine monk and do Lectio Divina for 2 hours every morning. You can listen to, you know, whatever app on your phone as you're on your, like, there's not a, this is how you have to do it. There's like, hey, scripture should be in the life and the consciousness of every Christian on some kind of a really regular basis. Community, like some, you should have close relationships where people know you and you are deeply known, and you should regularly find yourself around a table with other people that know you and love you and that are following Jesus together, because the center of our whole faith is a table. And so there are some of these, you know, Sabbath rest should find its way into your life, not in a religious checklist kind of way, in a surrender to the deepest desires of your heart. And that's really what a rule of life is. So Stephen Covey has that line that I quote in The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. I love it. About how we achieve inner peace when our schedule is aligned with our values.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think so much of the anxiety and the angst that a lot of us feel is our schedule is not aligned with our values.
Right.
And some of that is just the imperfection of life. We just like, you know, or that our values are wrong. But some of it is the choice architecture of our lives. And, you know, the point I make in the book is some people are so highly intentional about their career, about their glucose monitoring and diet and exercise, about their, you know, like soccer moms that have like insane 10-year plans for their kids' future sports life. And this is the scholarship they'll get into college by. And they're like, they're four. What if they suck at athletics? You know, whatever. And they're like winging it when it comes to the spiritual formation.
Mm-hmm.
Just going to church occasionally and trying to be more loving. And that is not, and I'm not to say that our formation into the people of love is no different than getting good at basketball or moving up the corporate ladder. It is very different, but there's a similarity in that it will require a thoughtful and intentional approach to our life as a whole. And that's what ancient Christians called a rule of life, which was just a, you know, I define it as a schedule and a set of practices and relational rhythms that organize our life around apprenticeship to Jesus and allow us to live in alignment with our deepest desires. And so that's where you don't ever start with the practices. You start first off with the vision of Jesus and life in the kingdom of God with Jesus. Until your heart is utterly captivated by the beauty of Jesus and the possibility of life in the kingdom, ignore everything in my book. Then you move to getting in touch with your heart's deepest desires to be with Jesus, to become like him, to be transformed into a person of goodness and love and happiness and joy and peace and long-suffering and courage and wisdom, and to do what he did, to fulfill your purpose in the world, to discover your destiny and deeply leave the world better off than you found it. Play your role in human flourishing, not just be a carbon footprint who's another streaming download stat for Netflix, but to be an image bearer of God. Once you get deeply in touch with those desires, which I think are primal human desires for love and acceptance, for goodness, and loving relationships, and for meaning and purpose. Once you get in touch deeply with those desires, then you sit down with a blank piece of paper, or you go to our website where we have a free piece of technology called the Rule of Life Builder, and you architect a life that will slowly, glacially, over decades, move you farther, closer and closer toward the dream of becoming that kind of person with Jesus. And so, and then you make a list of practices that you start doing. So that's why I think the hesitation me to name the nine practices, I'm happy to, but you're at like at least step four. Step one is vision of Jesus. Step two, get in touch with your deep desires. Step three, organize your life around those desires. Step four is, so here are the practices of Jesus that would be really helpful for you to move forward.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that you talk about in this book that I think is so helpful, and I would love for you to reiterate, is this idea that, and I think the quote is, self-effort is the key to spiritual formation. And that is a tricky thought, because I think, as you even said earlier, like willpower is when we think about faith in the Christian world, that's like a really tricky space.
Wait, you know what, mean? What is, like, are you reading that? I don't remember writing that. Is that, what's the context for that statement?
We have a long self-effort.
Are you reading an unedited
added some
copy?
Stuff. Yeah, we've added.
Yeah, this is the Dadville edited version. And then it goes on to say Dave Barnes' new album. See, this feels like you're writing.
There are two albums that every person must listen to.
That's right.
Taylor Swift's 1989 and Dave Barnes.
Yeah, that's right. So, no, but in it's at the beginning of I can tell you where I got that from. Give me time. But the idea that you're talking about in that moment is that this is something you have to engage. Like, I think it's really easy in this day and age, especially where I think Christendom has been over the last 30 years, feel like it's not about effort. you know, because that's when we get into trouble. Like willpower gets us into trouble because then we're, you know, it's works and God doesn't. But something you just you do a really good job laying this out throughout this book that we do. It takes effort. Like you can't growing in your spiritual formation is not something that is the Spirit just does in you and you wake up.
Well, don't you think the two things that get lumped together to all of our detriment is our salvation and our life, right? Like, it's not a, like when Dave, when you're saying like, so many people are like, it's not about effort. It's not about your works. I feel like, yes, when we're talking about our salvation and like, are we saved or, you know, all that kind of stuff. But then I feel like this is a book that's talking about, okay, you're here on this earth. You have a life.
Sanctification.
Like,
yeah.
You have a footprint to leave on this earth with all the people around you. It's more about that. Like, okay, we've checked the box of salvation. Now let's talk about your life, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many thoughts here, guys. Willard used to say, he had that line I love, I quote it in the book, grace isn't opposed to effort, it's opposed to earning.
Yeah.
And evangelicals or modern American Western Christians tend to conflate effort and earning and think they are the same thing. They are not remotely the same thing. Effort is an action, earning is an attitude. And so that's where you get sayings like, it's not about what you do, it's about what God has, what Christ has done for you. That is not a phrase used by any of the New Testament writers. I don't actually think that's a New Testament idea. It pits what we do against what Christ has done. And those two things are our friends, not enemies. And you know, we're at time, but this is where you know, if you're actually going to get seriously into formation, you have to start with what is the gospel and what is salvation. And unfortunately, I think that many Western evangelical Protestants misunderstand what the gospel is and misunderstand what salvation is. And this is deep, deep stuff that's hours of conversation. You know, Luther, I think, who did so much good in the world, but gave the kind of evangelical view of salvation in many ways. I think a number of scholars, N.T. Wright would be the most famous one, but a ton of scholars over the last few decades have basically lovingly but firmly said the Protestant reformers really misunderstood what salvation was. Luther interpreted Paul's language about, he interpreted grace to be the unmerited favor of God on our behalf, was the traditional definition that I'm sure you guys have heard many times. I sure have heard it many times. And the law was interpreted to be not the Jewish Torah around circumcision and Jewish ethnicity and ethnic markers, but it was interpreted to be self-effort in general. So people interpreted Paul's, you know, we are saved by grace through faith, not by works, to mean we are going to heaven when we die because we've been legally justified by the unmerited favor of God on our behalf, by believing the right things about God, not by self-effort. That's how evangelicals have understood Paul. And a number of scholars have said, whoa, 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 that's not what Paul is saying. Salvation is the healing and the transformation of the whole person through restoration of union with God and with other people and with their own self. Grace is God's action on our behalf. It's more like when we use the phrase, how did you get through that hard time? Oh, I just had grace for it. It's the empowering presence of the Holy Spirit in us, giving us capacities we do not have in our own willpower to be and do who we were always meant to be and do. And the law is not self-effort in general. We're deep into the theological weeds here, and I'm trying to make it high level. The law is most likely referring to the ethnic markers that were built into the Jewish Torah that kept Israel separate from the other nations. And most, you know, if you were to ask a first century Jew, how do you know that you are on the right side of God's love? They would not have said, because I do all this list of things. They would have said, because I'm Jewish and I'm circumcised and the Jewish people are the people of God. And because I'm Jewish, I'm good and I'm in. That's what most people would have said. So that's what Paul is fighting against, not self-effort, but like a racial superiority around soteriology. So all that to say, totally different if you read Paul as saying, We are transformed at our whole person through union with God by the action, by the empowering presence of Christ within us, giving us grace to be in who we are meant to be, all we are meant to be through fidelity and allegiance to Jesus as Lord, not because we are Jewish or circumcised or keep certain aspects of kosher food. That's what I think Paul is saying. And then that opens up a whole lifestyle of now I will apprentice under Jesus because I have to appropriate grace, you know. And again, I got to run, but, you know, I'm thinking here, I got my debit card right here, right in front of me. I got paid a couple of days ago. There's money in my account. There is wealth in my account. Not a lot, but there's some wealth in my account. But it's just an idea out there. I need a debit card. If I'm going to fill up my car with gas later, I'm going to buy dinner tonight for my family, I need some way to access grace. And in the same way, discipleship is a way to access. We're not earning grace, but practices like Sabbath and prayer, and they access grace. There are debit cards, clumsy analogy, but they're how we draw on the power of the Holy Spirit and the wealth of heaven to be deeply transformed and live rich and meaningful lives. So that's all I'll say. Enough for now.
Peace well, out. Love thank you, guys you so much that's for your time. And I just want to let me say a couple things. Everybody, the book really is unbelievably helpful. It's so great. And so you hear us say it. I'm really thankful for you, man. I really appreciate what you have to say. Your heart for helping people understand things is so palpable, and it's always so good to be with you. So thank you for the work that you do.
Really, you guys are so incredibly kind. The only sad thing about these podcasts is they're way too one-sided. And next time in your back house in Nashville, just chilling. All right.
There we go.
Yeah.
There we go.
I bought my dad that Paul McCartney book, by the way, that I saw last time I was in your Christmas present. Scored high. Nice. He loved it.
It's
good stuff.
So good.
It's a great book. Good. All right. Love you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on, man.